Hate to break it to you, but planning is a huge aspect of landscape photography, especially if you want to get some amazing photos. We're going to be talking about it in today's episode. What is up, everybody? Austin James Jackson here. You're listening to the Learn Landscape Photography Podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning in for today's episode. Well, it's about the end of July right now, and I'm already looking forwards to some of the photography events we've got happening later this year. Of course, there is the Perseid Meteor Shower in August, which is every August. This year is supposed to be a pretty good show. And then probably the main event, the main attraction this fall is, I believe, October 14th. We've got an annual solar eclipse. Got to start planning for that stuff now, figuring out exactly where you want to be and how you want to shoot it. Lucky for me, the annual solar eclipse runs right through the southern section of Utah, so I can almost capture it directly from my back porch. But either way, I'm going to be doing some planning and figuring out where I want to go, which brings up the topic of today's episode. In this episode, we are talking to someone who I consider to be the master of plan and execution when it comes to landscape photography. That person, if you haven't already guessed it by now, is Joshua Cripps. Now, Josh is an amazing landscape photographer based in the beautiful Lone Pine, California, just outside of Death Valley in the Alabama Hills. And he is probably one of the best when it comes to moon photography, when it comes to solar eclipse photography, on all that. He's got a lot of great photos. One of his photos that really always sticks out to me, he's got a photo of the solar eclipse, which we talk about in today's episode, where there's a camel and a person inside of the eclipse. And it's just such a cool photo. Of course, I'll link that down below. So I don't want to waste any more time beating around the bush here. Here is my conversation with Joshua Cripps. All right. Well, I'm really excited today to welcome Joshua Cripps to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here, Josh. And will you tell us about yourself for some of our listeners that might not be familiar with you and your work?
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, my name is Josh Cripps, and I like to call myself a wilderness landscape photographer, because although I love shooting landscapes of all kinds, the ones that really speak to my soul are the ones where the hand of man is really not evident, where you have to work a little bit harder, get a little bit deeper into the wilderness. That's where I've had the most beautiful, most important moments of my life, photographically and artistically. And so those are the things that I like to capture and to show people that we do really have these incredible wild spaces out there, closer than you think. You know, I live here in Lone Pine, California, which is exactly as big as it sounds. But, you know, I stare up at Mount Whitney, the highest peak in the lower 48 states, every single day. And we're only 3 hours from LA, you know, so we've got millions and millions of people living just a short drive away. And they're so close to one of the most incredible wildernesses in the U.S. In fact, I think the Kings Canyon Sequoia National Park backcountry is the second largest roadless wilderness in the contiguous 48 states. I think there's one in Idaho and one in Montana, and one of those is bigger and one is smaller. But I mean, it's like this 200-mile section of incredible wilderness with no roads going through it. And it's right there, 3 hours from LA. So I love to show people that kind of stuff. And yeah, that's a little bit about me.
That's a great answer. And I can tell that I am definitely not the first person to ask you that, because it was like, it's so well thought out. And I love that whole answer. And I'm really excited today to have you on the podcast. And when I messaged you a while back about being on the podcast, I was like, man, what are we going to talk about? There's so many different ways I think we could take this, because I think there's so many things that are just so cool about what you do. But I really think that you are second to none when it comes to planning a photo. I mean, when I look through your portfolio, it is really obvious that you've done a lot of planning, especially when it comes to shooting either the moon or the sun or night photography or anything like that. So I'm really hoping to learn a little more about that today. Will you just give us kind of, I know you could talk probably for hours about it, but will you give us kind of the TLDR on how you go about planning a shot surrounding the sun or the moon?
Yeah, absolutely, man. It is absolutely one of my favorite things to do, which is kind of ironic because most of the time my philosophy when it comes to photography is to be really organic about it and let the scene speak to you and let Mother Nature tell you the story that she wants to tell to respond to that. So get rid of your expectations, get rid of your preconceived ideas about what's supposed to happen. And that's a very satisfying way to approach landscape photography. But when it comes to photographing the moon or the sun or an eclipse, something that lined up, you know, that's what I like to do is line the moon up with something. It requires such a high level of planning. You have to pre-visualize almost every aspect of the entire shot, from where the moon is going to appear in the photograph relative to your subject, the time of day, the size of the moon, how far you're going to stand from your subject, down to the minute you're going to press the shutter button. Now, I think part of that comes from my background, which is my degree is in aerospace engineering. So I really like the technical stuff. I really like that high level planning. But it is a lot more stressful way to do photography. And so, yeah, when I'm trying to line up a shot, I'm trying to stack the deck in my favor as much as possible. And so I'm just basically I'm looking for cool moments. And for me, I really love when the moon is setting or rising around sunrise or sunset. So that's around a full moon, basically, when it aligns with something beautiful here on planet Earth, whether that's a unique mountain or a bristlecone pine or even a person standing on a hill far away. And so the short of it is basically I try to figure out for a given moment in time, like sunset or sunrise, that exact moment, or say the moment that light first strikes a mountain here in the Eastern Sierra, at that exact moment in time, where is the moon going to be, both in terms of the azimuth, how far around the compass it is from north, and the elevation, how high in the sky it is. And if you know those two things, then all you have to do is put yourself into a position where your subject has the same approximate angle around the compass and angle up into the sky as the moon at that exact moment. And you just get yourself to the right spot. You stand there with your long lens. You hope that a cloud doesn't blow in at the last second. And, I use photo pills to help me plan all this stuff. And their motto is plan and pray. And I've modified that for myself a little bit to become plan, panic. Because you can line things up as much as possible in advance. But in that last minute, there's always something crazy that happens where you just got to, shuffle. You got to move to a new spot, or you realize your composition doesn't work and you got to just shake it up. But that's the quick of it is find the angles, line them up, and then hope for the best.
Yeah. That's perfect. And one of the things that I'm always telling people, especially some of my clients, is that you can become a really good photographer just doing what other people are doing. But if you really want to become over the top great and you want people to know who you are and grow a following, you really got to do something that's unique and offer something that someone else doesn't offer. One of the things that I think really opened my eyes to that when it comes to your photography and the planning process is you've got your annual solar eclipse from, it was like 2 or 3 years ago, or you've got the photo with the camel, the person holding the camel. Everything, it's obvious to me that everything is so perfectly planned. And I know that wasn't you're walking around with your telephoto lens and, oh, hey, look, there's a guy over there. I know that you were standing exactly where you needed to be. You had him stand exactly where he needed to be. And that was a solar eclipse that was photographed by millions at least of photographers, and most of whom just framed out the sun and got a pretty good shot that way. But you were able to find a way to make your shot unique and original. And it really stands out. And it's something that when I think of the annual solar eclipse, I think of your photo. I don't think of all the other normal photos of just the sun. So can you speak to the whole thought process of that, I guess, project, as you could call it?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks, man. I appreciate those kind words. And I have to deflect some of the credit for that shot to a guy named Ted Hesser, who during the total solar eclipse of October 2017, he lined up a shot in Smith Rock State Park of a rock climber with the eclipse right behind him. And he planned that shot out, and he had a bunch of people like Chris Burkhard was using him to help plan that same shot. But Ted was the guy who planned it. And like you said, I've seen lots of photos of solar eclipses, and it's always like the first one you see, each eclipse is pretty cool. And then the second one, you're like, okay, that's fine. And then by the time you've seen 40, you know, coronal shots of the solar eclipse, you're getting a little bit ho-hum about the whole thing. And then I saw Ted Hesser's rock climber shot during the eclipse, and I thought, wow, it is possible to put a subject next to the eclipse in a really cool way. So that opened my eyes to some of the possibilities. You know, I was already doing some moon photography around then. And so this was sort of like the beginning of my realization of what's possible when you line up the moon, the sun, and eclipse with a subject. You can get some amazing shots. So big shout out to Ted Hesser for that, for opening my eyes. But when it comes to the camel idea, basically what happened was, I was going to be on a, conference at sea for digital nomads, and that conference ended in Dubai. So I was on a cruise, and it started in Athens and it ended in Dubai a couple of days before Christmas. And I was talking to Raphael Pons, who's the bard for Photo Pills, their main like ambassador, or not ambassador, evangelist, whatever you want to call it. He, you know, he's the guy, he's the face of Photo Pills. And he was like, oh, cool. Are you going to photograph the eclipse that's going right through the United Arab Emirates, you know, a week after Christmas? And I said, well, I didn't even know there was an eclipse going through there, because I was only thinking about like coming back to California and the eclipse wasn't visible and blah, blah, blah. That, well, there's just an opportunity I can't pass up. And so then I started to brainstorm, you know, what can I put in the frame with an eclipse that's A, going to be aesthetic, and B, is going to be representative of the region where the eclipse is going to be, you know? So,
oh, that's so great.
The Middle East, right? And like the eclipse goes through a lot of different areas. It went through, it started in like Saudi Arabia, I think was the very first place you could see it, but it went through UAE, it went through Philippines, Indonesia, a bunch of the ocean, you know? It's like you could photograph it in a lot of those places, but in some areas, you know, maybe it's going to be cloudy, like in the tropics, or the eclipse is really high in the sky. And so it really worked out well photographing it in UAE, because it was going to happen right after sunrise, which meant that the eclipse was going to be low to the horizon, much easier to line it up with something, anything, doesn't matter what it is. It's going to be a lot easier when it's 7 degrees up in the sky instead of 60 degrees up in the sky, like it was in Indonesia. And so I just basically wrote out a big long list. You know, when I think of the Middle East, and I did a little bit of research, you know, into the culture and just the general area, and a few things popped up: horses, camels, oryxes, falcons, you know, mosques, Bedouins, like all of this sort of classic Arabian Nights type imagery that we think about when we think of the Middle East here in the West. And so I went through each of the items on the list, and I thought about what's going to make, you know, what's going to be easy to pull off. It would be amazing to get a, you know, an oryx out in the desert, but yeah, like you said, you're not just going to be wandering around. Oh, luckily there's an oryx on top of that dune. No. So we had to,
what is an oryx? That might be a dumb question, but I don't know what an oryx is.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen pictures of them. They have them in Namibia as well. It's an ant. It's one of those antelopes that has that really beautiful, long curved horns.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing animals. Absolutely gorgeous. And they have them in the UAE. I don't know if they're wild, if they've been imported or what, but they do have them there. And, but I thought like, the chances of just stumbling across one at the moment of eclipse, give me a break. Yeah. You know, and so I was going through all these possibilities, and, you know, I started ranking them by like safety net level. You know, I'm sure that I could find a person with a falcon. Like that would be an easy thing to do and just have them stand up there. But I really wanted, you know, a big animal. And so I contacted another photographer in Dubai, and I said, hey man, do you know where I could get a camel? And he was like, he's like, well, I don't, but I, there's another photographer who does workshops out in the desert, and he has, domesticated camels and horses that he has people photograph. So let me call him. And he calls that guy up, and he's like, well, I'm not doing any workshops right now, but let me call the farm where you know, where I get my camels and horses from. So he calls them up and they're like, well, we're out of the country, but let's call up the guys who work at the farm. And so through this whole big chain, I basically this text, this message on WhatsApp. And it was like, hi, my name is Abdul Rahim. I work at the camel farm. You know, I heard you need a camel. And anyway, I'm sort of jumping ahead because like I thought about, you know, what's going to look cool against the eclipse. And I figured an animal and a person would be amazing because you have that fuzzy factor, you know, the hairs of the coat.
Yeah.
And it's going to catch that rim light and it's really going to glow. Whereas, you know, the minarets on a mosque would be amazing because they have the same shape, that sickle shape, but made out of metal or ceramic or whatever, they're probably not going to catch light in the same way. They might not get that rim lighting. And so I was struggling to make that work conceptually in my head. And that's how I landed on an animal. And then through this whole series of events, yeah, it turns out the guy just, he didn't have any horses. He just had camels. So that kind of was like, okay, there we go. The guy with the camel farm, that's our option. Done. And so then the next step, like you said, it was really excruciatingly planned out because I had a very specific vision, which was I wanted the eclipse to completely encircle the camel and the guy. And initially I just was going to have the camel, but then I realized, well, the camel, it's just going to walk off if somebody's not holding it. So we have to have the guy holding the camel too. And so that changes the equation because now instead of having the eclipse just encircle one thing, it's got to encircle two things. So the eclipse has to appear larger relative to the subject, which means I've got to stand back farther. So finding the exact spot, that really took a lot of time. It took about an hour or so once we got out to the camel farm, which was right in the middle of the path of the eclipse, which was perfect, of finding just the right dune where it was exactly, and I forget the specific numbers, but it's like 6.18 degrees in elevation at the moment of eclipse. But I have to be exactly 1,000 feet or more away from it so the eclipse is big enough to encircle. Because if I'm any closer than that, then the man, the camel get bigger relative to the size of the sun and the moon, and they're going to be bigger than the eclipse. And so it was this very precise, like at 7:03 a.m., the moon's going to, the man has to be on top of the dune at exactly 6.18 degrees, and I'm exactly 1,000 feet back, and that's it. Like that's the moment of truth. And so that's kind of how the whole thing came about, started with a concept, and then it just started, you know, drilling down through all the factors into what's a good subject, what's a good vision for the shot, when's it going to happen, how do we pull it off, and just knocking out all those factors. And then in the moment, you know, hardly got any sleep the night before because I was really, really anxious about whether there would be haze or clouds or anything like that, if we'd even see it. You know, I'd spent so much time and money getting there and planning all this. Uh-huh. And then I was like, is it going to even work? And then, you know, the cool thing is math works. Like math just works. So if you do your math right, you can trust in the plan. And sure enough, like it pretty much worked out perfectly. The only hitch, I will say there was a hitch, which was my initial vision was to have the moment of the annulus, the ring of fire going around the man and the camel. And I screwed up that plan because in measuring the height of the dune where the camel was going to stand, I'm relying on the information from Google Maps. And, you know, they're only accurate to like plus or minus 30 feet, something like that. And that's fine if you're photographing a mountain that's 10 miles away or whatever. But, you know, if you're photographing something that is only 1,000 feet away from you, the difference of 30 feet is a significant bar of uncertainty. And so it actually turned out that the sand dune was about 30 feet taller than I had calculated it to be, which meant that at the moment of peak eclipse, the eclipse wasn't visible. It was behind the dune because it was still 30 feet, you know, too low. And so I just had to sit there and wait. I couldn't really back up anymore for a couple of reasons. Normally you can just back up and that'll cause the moon or the sun or whatever to go up into the sky. But in this case, I couldn't do it. And so I just had to sit there and wait. And it was the most painful 3 minutes of my life waiting for this, you know, moon to arise. But when it finally came up, when the eclipse arose above the man and the camel, it actually was a better shot because it had, instead of the ring of fire, which would have been freaking cool as hell, I'm sure of it, but it had the sickle shape. You know, it had that shape that's so evocative of the Middle East, that it just was one of those happy accidents. And so, a little screw up ended up working out okay. And that's kind of the short version of that story.
Well, that's amazing. I honestly thought you were going to tell us when the dune wasn't high enough that you had a shovel and you dug or something crazy like that. But I think it looks awesome. I'm definitely going to link that photo in the podcast notes for anyone that wants to see it. I think it's just incredible, that whole deal. And I think that really leads well into my next question. How important is it in order to spend a lot of time to increase your odds at getting a great shot and not coming home empty handed?
Are you talking about planning specifically this kind of photograph or in general with photography?
Just in general, any kind of photography.
Yeah. I would say no matter what level you are at as a photographer, the number one thing you can do to improve the quality of photos in your portfolio is simply spend more time outside. And, you know, obviously it's a great thing to invest in your skills and improve to that you can capture images in the way that you want to capture them. But even if you're a total beginner, if you just go outside a bunch, you're going to see a lot more stuff. You're going to see cooler weather, you're going to see weirder, crazier, more dramatic, more colorful, whatever conditions. And even if you don't have the opportunity to travel to exotic locations, you know, if you can just go down to your neighborhood park, or if you live along the coast and there's a favorite beach or something like that, and you just go back to that beach every single night, then you are going to just see stuff. And the more you see stuff, the more you're going to have all kinds of different fodder for your portfolio. You know, that's just it. You're just going to have more raw material. And the more time you can spend, the better your results are going to be. And period. I mean, I think that goes pretty much for anything in life. But yeah, doubly so for an artistic pursuit. Just spend the time. Absolutely.
Yep. The more days you go out, the better chance you have of something really cool happening or seeing something really cool one of those days. And I know earlier you talked about photo pills. Is there any other apps that you use to help you to plan something like a eclipse or a moonshot or anything like that?
Yeah, there is. So mostly I use photo pills, but then I also use an app called Peakfinder. And Peakfinder is really cool because when you go into the field, it actually draws a line diagram of the topography around you and identifies the different mountains from your vantage point. And it shows a trace of where the sun and the moon will appear and disappear. And it shows the to the minute moment that they'll appear and disappear. So PhotoPills is absolutely a wonderful tool, and it can calculate things with extraordinary precision, but the accuracy of the tool is only as good as your ability to accurately place the your shooting location and your subject location within the app. And so if you have a little bit of uncertainty of like, okay, I'm trying to place, you know, my subject location on this sand dune, but I'm not really sure if it's the right dune, I can't identify it on the map or this or that, you know, that uncertainty is going to find its way into your results. Whereas Peakfinder, it'll just draw the skyline and go, oh, the sun disappears here at 6:14, or the moon pops up here at 5:22. And so that is really handy. That's like a total idiot proof. Like you just point it at the landscape and go, oh, okay, here it comes in 2 minutes.
I want to take a break from today's episode and talk about a really cool opportunity if you are a beginner or intermediate photographer that is really serious about taking better photos and getting better at photography. Now, usually about 4 to 6 times a year, I teach in-person workshops around the Western United States centered around helping you become a better photographer. Now, my workshops are kept to just 5 people, which means that you will get plenty of one-on-one attention. So regardless of your skill level, whether you just picked up your first camera or whether you've been shooting for 15 years, I promise you, you're going to get so much out of it. I'm going to cater the class directly to you. Best of all, after the workshop, I'm going to add you to my alumni group on Facebook, where you can get literally weekly image feedback. We can connect at all times. When the workshop is over, it's not done. I'm still going to be your mentor. I'm going to be there to help you and become better at photography. Now, like I said, if you're serious about becoming better at photography, don't wait any longer. Register for one of my workshops this year. You can visit austinjamesjackson.com/workshops. That link will be down below in the podcast description that you can click on as well. I really can't wait to see you guys out there. So we get a full moon about once a month. Like, the moon phases take about a month. I think it's like 29 and a half days or something like that. Is there something in particular that you're looking for in order to make a moonshot worthy to shoot on any particular evening?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I look for the timing. You know, I want the moon and the landscape to be illuminated if possible. I'm looking for the phase of the moon, like you said, a full moon. Sometimes a full moon is not actually ideal because the lighting in a situation where you're photographing the full moon is very flat. It's like having the world's biggest pop-up flash when the sun, because the way that the full moon works is, you know, when you're at a full moon, it's in the exact opposite part of the sky as the sun. And so, you know, if you have the sun behind you and then your subject and the moon in front of you, they're lit totally front lit. They have no shadow. They can appear really flat. The image quality is kind of blah occasionally. So I actually like to photograph maybe around the day before the full moon or the day after the full moon, sometimes even 2 days after the full moon. The moon will still be 98, 96% full. So it looks really full, but there's just enough off-axis light to bring in some shadows and depth and dimension, both to the craters of the moon around the edges, as well as, you know, if you're photographing a mountain, then it can bring in that texture into the mountain as well. So I look for that. I look for any kind of unique, you know, I really love to photograph the moon when it rises just before sunset. And a lot of times you can get it in the belt of Venus, which is like, if you've never seen a full moon rising in the belt of Venus, oh, it's so beautiful. It's really just a wonderful thing to experience. So I love to look for that kind of thing.
What makes it different when it rises in the belt of Venus, and how often does that happen?
You know, it doesn't happen that often. Yeah, because the full moon, of course, it's not on a perfect metronome with our daily, diurnal cycle. And so like one full moon, the moon rise might be at 8 p.m. with sunset being at 8:02 p.m. And then next full moon, it might rise like 10 minutes before sunset, or maybe even 30 minutes after sunset. And it's just the way that those celestial dynamics work. And it's complicated stuff. So it's really nice to have an app to tell you that. But a lot of times what happens if the moon is rising, so the coloration of the moon is a cool thing, because depending on when it rises, it will appear to be different colors based on the different phases of the daytime. You know, so we see the moon, we're used to seeing the moon during the day. It looks very white. If you see the moon rising just after sunset, I'm sure everybody has seen this. It looks really orange, or like a Halloween moon, you know, or like a deep yellow. And sometimes if you get it at just the right moment where it's rising in that belt of Venus, the moon will be pink. Because it's getting that, you know, those last little longest rays of sunlight that are getting filtered through the atmosphere. You're getting that. So the sunlight's hitting the moon, and then it's bouncing off and going through all the atmosphere and turning the same kind of color as the sunset color. And so you can get this like pink moon in the blue earth shadow. And it's pretty special.
Wow. I had no idea. I mean, I've seen that before. I just didn't know why that was. So that's good to know. And one of the things that I wanted to mention, especially one of the things that I see a lot when I teach workshops, is people that are maybe they're new to photography or they haven't been shooting that long. They don't understand what compression is and what it does for your photos. And I think that there's so many of your photos where you use compression and it just looks fantastic. Will you explain how this works and why photographers may use this in order to create more compelling photos?
Yeah, absolutely. Compression is such an incredibly useful tool when it comes to creating impact, not just with a foreground element, but with a background element as well. You know, I think a lot of us, when we get started, we love those in-your-face foregrounds, and like that's it. That's all I chased for 10 years. You know, and you got to find the most incredible punch you in the eyeballs foreground. And one of the downsides of doing that, and when you go with your super wide angle lens to emphasize your foreground, is your background gets really small. And so you lose a little bit of the emphasis on your background element. And the idea behind compression is simply that you can adjust the relative impact of your foreground and your background by stepping back and zooming in. And the more that you step back and zoom in, the more that your foreground element will become minimized relative to, say, a wide angle shot where you're right up on top of it, but the more that your background element will become exaggerated. And so if you were, just as an example, speaking of the moon, you know, go out and photograph the moon with a wide angle lens, and it becomes these 10 little bright pixels in your frame, you know. Yeah. And your foreground is big and powerful, but the moon is this little speck. And so if you want the moon to appear larger, yeah, the more you can back off from your subject and zoom in, then the more that basically you're sort of minimizing the, like, the farther away you get from your foreground subject, the smaller it becomes relative to the background element. And then when you zoom in, you magnify both of those things. And so the background element just gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the foreground element gets smaller and smaller. And so depending on what's important to you, what you want to emphasize, that is a great tool to keep in the playbook. And I mean, it can just make, if you really want to provide a sense of scale, if you want to show people the world in a way that they don't typically notice it, then that tool of standing far back from a foreground and zooming way in with on some compelling background, I mean, it can just make mountain peaks look enormous. Like if you have a small figure in front of a mountain peak that you're far away and you zoom in, gosh, it's just the coolest sense of scale. Or with the moon again, you know, you can step back. Like I'm looking at Mount Whitney right now, and you know, the face of Mount Whitney is 1500 feet tall, the east face, but I can make the moon appear almost 1500 feet tall. If I just go far enough away from Mount Whitney, you know, the mountain gets smaller and smaller and smaller. The moon stays the same size relative, you know, in the sky. And I zoom in, and that's how you can create a huge impact with your background element.
Yeah, absolutely. And for anyone listening, you really, next time you go out shooting, try just backing up and zooming in, which sounds really counterintuitive, because when you back up, you get further away, and then you're going to zoom in to bring it closer. But that'll give you this nice compression effect, and you will seriously create some really cool photos if you do that. So the next thing I wanted to ask here, it kind of expands outside of the scope of the topic of this episode, but I would be a fool to not talk to you about it, because I really love the way that you edit your photos. Would you tell us just briefly, what does your editing workflow look like? I mean, Lightroom, Photoshop, like, how are you usually editing your photos?
My editing workflow is pretty simple, I would say. And it really starts in the field with a bit of pre-visualization. And I'm thinking about what it is that I'm trying to capture, what it is that I want that most speaks to me in the moment, and what it is that I want my viewers to take away from a photograph. And so if I know that, if I have that conscious concept in my mind, then all I'm trying to do in post-processing is continue that journey of emphasis and de-emphasis. And so for the most part, my editing is just in Lightroom. I'd say I do 98% of all my work in Lightroom. I really like, for me, the power of a good photograph is in the moment, the magic of the moment. And so I don't have a ton of really complex processing. I just like to go out, find beautiful places when cool things are happening, you know, take the best raw file that I can. And then, yeah, I'll just do some simple edits in Lightroom to bring out the color, contrast, and detail. So a lot of times I'm darkening the sky, brightening the foreground, you know, pulling down the highlights, boosting the shadows. I add contrast with the tone curve, which has a lot of control over exactly which tonal ranges you're adding contrast to. And then if I need to, I'll jump in and I'll do some local edits where it's like, okay, I need to brighten this corner, or this part's a little bit too saturated, or pull up these shadows over here. And a lot of times I don't necessarily have a specific, it's more of that part's a little bit more reactive, I'd say, where I look at the photo and I just have a gut feeling about what it needs. And I think a really important part of my post-processing workflow is taking a break from post-processing. And that's a critical step that we don't talk a lot about as part of post-processing, but it's really important to just turn your computer off, turn your eyes off, and walk away for a while, and then come back. And I swear the next time you look at an image you've just processed, you'll instantly say, oh my God, foreground, it's way too bright, or those clouds are super saturated, or they need to be more, you know, I need to increase the saturation or the luminance of just the blues or this or that. Like you'll see it. It'll pop out to you instantly. So I do most of that stuff in Lightroom. If I need to do any really high level cleanup, like cloning out a bunch of branches, or if I have a bunch of dust spots, a lot of dust spots, then I go to Photoshop. If I have to do any exposure blending, I like to do that in Photoshop. Although, to be honest with you, I can't really remember the last time I did an exposure blend, just because modern sensors are so incredible. I'm looking at a photo on my desktop right now, shooting directly into the sun, you know, and there's full detail through the shadow, the sun, I mean, everything. So, but if I have to exposure blend, yeah, I do that in Photoshop. And then the only other part of my process that I haven't mentioned is if I'm going to print a photo or if I'm going to put it up on my website, because I like to use really high res photos on my website. It has a totally different feel when you're looking at an image online and it fills your whole monitor versus just a little, you know, 1,000 pixel wide square.
Absolutely.
So what I'll do is if I like the image and it's going to go to print or on the website, I'll run it through, I use DxO Pure Raw, but it's basically the same as Topaz Denoise or Lightroom Denoise, just one of the AI processors, cleans up the noise and increases the level of detail. And then, yeah, I'll paste my edits, my Lightroom edits back on top. And that's pretty much it. So I look at some of the incredible post-processing that's out there. You know, Nick Page always springs to mind as an incredibly talented post-processing, expert. And I love the way his images look. And I'm sure that I could learn a lot and pull some of his tools into my workflow as well. But I find that I just like to keep it simple. And so I don't do too much.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're out there and you're getting great conditions, then a lot of times you need to do less editing because you've already got everything perfect already. It's usually when you get those kind of subpar conditions and you're trying to make something from nothing that you'll run into having to do a lot of editing, in my experience.
Yep, absolutely. And just really quickly to interject one last point along that those lines, the Eclipse photo, the post-processing that I did on that Eclipse photo was I had to brighten it about a stop in post. And I added a little bit more warmth. So that's it. That's in total. Jeez. My post-processing on that shot.
Nice.
Because the moment was so incredible. And I was like, I want to add a little bit more warmth for that deserty feel. And it's not quite bright enough. And okay, done.
Yeah. So why don't you tell me, is there a common mistake that you see frequently in photo editing, or is there something that you wish you'd known when you started photography?
You know, I would say that a real common mistake that I see is people thinking that they need to be really expert post-processors to be good photographers. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that in the online education world, it's a lot easier to teach post-processing than it is to teach conceptual photography. You can have a very clear outcome by creating a Photoshop processing course that is very explicit about what it accomplishes and the skills you'll gain versus trying to create a course around something like creative photography or finding your vision as a photographer, right? Like that's a lot harder to create an encapsulized course, and it's certainly less, I think it's less showy too, right? Like post-processing, you can do these dramatic before and afters. But one of the byproducts of doing that is I think that there is a lot more, a disproportionate number of YouTube videos and online courses created around post-processing, just because it's easier to make those courses, than there is around the truly fundamentally important parts of photography, like vision and creativity and, you know, following your specific aesthetic, because that's just sort of this nebulous concepts. And that would indicate to, you know, just a consumer of photography education that post-processing has this, like, okay, 50% of all the stuff out there is about post-processing. That must be 50% of what photography is. And so I think that's kind of a problem. People think they need to be an expert post-processor. And then the other, I wouldn't say it's a mistake per se, but I would say that people are afraid of making mistakes in their post-processing. And so, you know, a lot of times people will ask if we're doing image review or something, oh, is this too much? Is this too much contrast? Is this too much? Well, A, my opinion doesn't really matter. You know, it's your photography. I can maybe give you my take on it, but that's for me. But B, you know, if you're just editing in Lightroom, for example, and you never even go into Photoshop, all of your edits are non-destructive and you can make virtual copies and you can edit the same photo 50 different ways if you want. Like, what's the only way you're going to know if your sky is too blue or too warm, or if your black and white is too contrasty? Try it. Just try tweaking it and then make a virtual copy, or, like, you know, look at it 3 days later and you'll go, oh, it actually, yeah, I can see that it was too blue, or there is too much clarity in here, or whatever the case may be. So, like I said, people are afraid to make what they perceive as mistakes. And actually, this is true in all of human endeavor, right? People are so afraid of mistakes. But I think the best way to look at it is it's not even a mistake. It's an opportunity for learning. So if you're not sure what you're doing, don't look at it as, oh, I might screw this up. Look at it as, here's an opportunity to learn and to grow. But the only way you can do that is by trying something, seeing if you like it, and iterating on that. So like I said, Lightroom now has these incredible tools, virtual copies, non-destructive edits. You can just try stuff. Try, fiddle, and pretty soon you'll find that you have a clear idea of what you like and don't like.
That is such solid advice. One thing that I find myself doing so much is when I go, so I shoot an auto white balance and I'll go to adjust the white balance after I take a photo, and I'll be like, okay, that looks good. That's fine. And then I'll close my computer and I'll come back another day and I'll adjust the white balance again. And I'll be like, oh, duh, how did I not see that it was too magenta or it was too warm or too cool or whatever? And it's just like you said, you just need to try something, because then you'll see a before image and an after image, and you're going to be like, oh, duh, like that looks so much better. So trying things is just so huge. One thing I like to always ask, I've had a few people on the podcast that do lead workshops. Is there a common thing that you teach people that's kind of like an aha moment for them, or like a time when things really click?
Yeah, there are a few things that spring to mind. I mean, I would say
it's a hard question. Sorry.
No, that's all right. The first thing that comes to mind is a technical point, which is understanding what the histogram is really telling you. Because if you can read a histogram well, you're going to be so set in terms of making sure you have good data. I like to tell people, you know, in the field, we're not trying to take pretty pictures that we can show off on the back of our camera. We're trying to gather good data that we can bring back to, you know, the dark room, the digital dark room, to really bring our vision to life. And so, yeah, knowing what your histogram is telling you, that one is absolutely so critical. And then I would say, in terms of more of the conceptual side of things, is what we just talked about, actually. You can apply those same ideas to the field, which is try something. You know, when I'm leading photo tours, one of the most common questions I get is along the lines of, do you think it would look better if I did X or Y? You know, should I get closer to my foreground? Should I include more sky? Do you think that this shutter speed, you know, captures the waterfall the way that it needs to? And the answer I always give is, I don't know. Let's give it a try and see what you like. And, you know, we have like the memory card that's in my camera has 3,000, right? It has storage capacity for 3,000 raw files. Like, yeah. Just try two more different shots. You know, I do that all the time. I'm not, and every pro photographer, every talented photographer that anybody out there follows on Instagram, I guarantee you it's the same way. They don't walk out into the field and go, there's my composition, got it, lined it up, boom, single shot, I'm done, that's it, I'm home. No, it's, you see an idea, you try something, you look at it, you see what you like and don't like about it, you iterate on that. And there are days when you feel super focused, at least this happens to me, and you're like in that flow state and composition just comes to you naturally, everything's working great. And there are other days I go out there and I just go, I can't tell if this is working. I can't tell if this is a great comp or a shitty comp, or if it's really creative or it's super hacky. I just can't tell today. And in those situations, you know what I do is I just try a bunch of different stuff. And I just trust in the idea that, you know, rather than being stuck because I don't have enough options, or I should say like being afraid to do the wrong thing or make the wrong composition, I just give myself as many opportunities as I can, you know, for down the road. Maybe I like didn't get enough sleep that night or something, and I can look at those the next day and go, oh, well, here's the clear winner. This composition has just the right balance. So yeah, that's the main thing, is like, don't be afraid to just try stuff. Every photographer, all the pros, they are trying stuff all the time. And yeah, so I would really encourage people, like, know your gear. We'll talk about that, I think, in just a little bit more. But yeah, just trying a bunch of different stuff. And that's how you build your, you know, your photography IQ and intuition as well, is just giving it a whirl.
That's perfect. Great advice. You already given us so much advice. The last question I always like to ask here on the podcast, and I ask every single person this, is that if you had one single piece of advice for a photographer that's trying to get better at photography, what would it be? And it doesn't have to be at all related to anything we talked about today, but just one general piece of advice for people that are trying to get better.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing that springs to mind is knowing your equipment. And the reason that I say that, even though I truly believe that equipment is the least important part of the photographic process, you know, you can't buy a bad camera anymore. However, you can buy a camera that you have to fight. You know, I've seen this so many times, and I'm sure you have as well on your workshops, is the idea, somebody thinks, okay, I'm going on this once in a lifetime opportunity, you know, to photograph in New Zealand or Utah or wherever. I want to make the most of it. So I'm going to buy a new camera right before the trip. And they'll show up and they don't know how to use the functions. They don't know how to zoom in or access the histogram, or how to turn off the, you know, how to set the, like on the Sony's, how to set a bulb timer and all this kind of stuff. And so you have to ask yourself, if you're in a once in a lifetime situation, you know, and you're flying over the fjords of New Zealand and the light, you know, there's beams of light streaming through the clouds and it's just the most beautiful thing you've seen in the world. Would you rather have a brand new camera that you're fiddling with and fighting, or, you know, a two generations ago camera that you know like the back of your hand? And so this is what I tell everybody who now comes on any workshop or any photo tour with me. I have this bullet point list of about 20, 25 things. And if you know how to do those 25 things, and it's nothing surprising. It's like, know how to access the histogram, both in playback and on live view. Know how to zoom into 100% quickly in playback and in live view. Know how to change your shooting mode from single shot to continuous to shutter or to a timer mode. Know how to turn on the blinkies or the zebra stripes and like all these little things. If you can do those things, what happens is all of a sudden your equipment, you know, fades into the process, right? Like your equipment can be a barrier between you and a photograph, or it can be the tool that allows you to capture a photograph. So even if you don't have an opportunity to go out and shoot that much, maybe you don't live in an area where you have access to extraordinary landscapes, that shouldn't be an excuse as to why you don't know how to use your camera. Just go out into the backyard and practice the mechanics of your equipment, even tripod usage. Know how to set your tripod up quickly on uneven surfaces. I have seen people miss more shots than I can count because they are struggling setting their tripod up on a couple of rocks of different height, and then all of a sudden the light just disappears. And so that Absolutely. Would be my number one piece of advice. If you can get to the point where your equipment is second nature and intuitive, you're going to be able to grab so many more photographs because you're just not fighting against yourself to get to that place of pressing the shutter button.
And you could focus more on the creative aspect of capturing photos rather than focusing on, gosh, how do I change the aperture again? Or 100%. How do I change the white balance? And so you can focus more on getting the photos. So that's great. That's actually a new one. I hear a lot of similar answers to that question, and that's a new one. So you're the first one to give us the master your gear advice. Will you tell us again? Thank you so much, Josh, for being on the podcast. Why don't you tell us where we can find more of your work, where we can buy from you, where can we learn from you, et cetera. Give us the whole nine yards here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you can find me on pretty much all the social media, Joshua Cripps Photography. My website is Joshua Cripps or joshuacrippsphotography.com. They both work. And that's the best place. So my website, that's my home, I would say, on the internet, more so than Instagram. I love Instagram for interacting with people, but if you want to join a workshop or a photo tour or see my portfolio, the images I'm most proud of, then definitely come find me on my website. And that's where I'm living online. All my goodies are there.
And you have a gallery that opened recently, correct?
That's right. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that I opened a gallery here in Lone Pine. If you don't know Lone Pine, if you're listening to this, you never heard of Lone Pine, but you know the Alabama Hills, that's where the Alabama Hills are at. So I'm right on Main Street. I'm about a block north of the one stoplight we have here in town, and it's called the Mount Whitney Gallery. Because you just stare up at Mount Whitney all day from it. And it showcases my photographs from pretty much just the Eastern Sierra, this geographic location. So even though I have photos from all around the world, here in the gallery, it's California mountains, essentially. I've been open since May. So I'm coming up on my third month now. And it's been a real fascinating process. That I could spend a whole other podcast talking about the world of learning how to run a physical art gallery. If anybody's out there, stop on by. I try to stay open weekends. But if the light is good, then I have to admit, I don't have any qualms about putting a closed sign on the window, a gone hiking sign. So if you do think you want to come through Lone Pine and visit, just send me a message and I'll let you know if the gallery is going to be open or not. But yeah, I'd love to talk photography and I love to show people what I'm doing. So the invite is open to everybody listening to come through Lone Pine and stop at the gallery and say hi.
And if it's closed in the afternoon, then you better get out into the mountains and start shooting, because that must mean that the light is good, right?
That's exactly right, man. Yeah, we have beautiful light here year round. We're in thunderstorm season right now. And so we get just crazy dramatic stuff going on during the summer. And then fall color is right around the corner. And then, wintertime, the quality of the light here, it's just absolutely breathtakingly beautiful through the whole winter. So there's never a bad time to come out here and do some photography. Absolutely.
Nice. Well, again, Josh, thank you so much for being here. Such a helpful episode. And there's going to be some really great stuff. This is going to be one of those episodes you want to listen to twice or three or four times if you can.
Well, thanks, Austin. Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. I hope everybody enjoys it, and looking forward to catching y'all out in the field sometime.
Man, well, here it is again. That was such an incredibly helpful episode. I know it's a long one, but do listen to it again if you can. Like I always recommend to listen to the episodes multiple times, but seriously, so much good information. And my conversation with Josh was just so much fun. Man, I wanted to keep coming up with questions on the fly because he just kept having some such great answers for us. So many helpful things that I think you guys can learn from. And even me, there was some stuff that I learned there as well. I think we all can have something to learn from this episode. And I think one of my favorite things about Josh is just how humble he is. I mean, can we just take a second to appreciate that? I mean, as I'm looking at his Instagram right now, he's got 124,000 followers. He's internationally known and he does tours, the whole nine yards, and he's just such a humble guy. I mean, I just really appreciated talking to him. Love the humbleness, and he's just such a great photographer. He's got so many great photos. I'm a huge fan. So I was so stoked to talk to Josh, and I really hope that you guys could see that in today's episode and that you really got some useful stuff out of it. So that is all for my conversation with Joshua Cripps. Really hope you guys will consider doing some planning for some of the events happening later this year. Like I mentioned before, the Perseid meteor shower, the annual lunar eclipse, a lot of good stuff to see around here. And it's always good to look forward to later this year, as I don't know about you guys, but right now it is 110 degrees where I live. So it's time to look forwards to when it's a little bit cooler and there's a little bit more going on in the photography world. Again, I want to thank you guys so much for listening to the Learn Landscape Photography Podcast. Your support means everything to me. And if you guys could, if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure to subscribe or whatever they call it on your, whatever you're listening to your podcasts on. Make sure that you get those episodes every Monday morning. As I mentioned before, my goal is to give you amazing content that's going to help you become a better photographer in as little time as possible. Thank you guys again so much for listening. We will see you guys next time. This is Austin James Jackson signing out.